The Tom Woods Show, episode 490.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, if you're interested in more libertarian podcasts, let me recommend to you the Jason Stapleton program hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. Monday through Friday, he gives you a libertarian look at the news. Check him out at jasonstapleton.com. Welcome to the show. Today, we're talking to Professor Klaus Rinn, who is a professor of politics at Catholic University. We're going to be talking about neoconservatism because Professor Rinn has written such extraordinary material on the phenomenon of neoconservatism from the point of view of a conservative who is horrified by it that I thought my audience would really, really enjoy this and benefit from it. Professor Rinn is a professor of politics at Catholic University. He's the author of many books, including America the Virtuous, Democracy and the Ethical Life, the book we're going to be talking about today, The New Jacobinism, and others. He is the chairman of the National Humanities Institute and editor of the academic journal Humanitas. His name, by the way, is spelled C-L-A-E-S and then R-Y-N. Professor Rinn, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I have been talking about your work or quoting it one way or another for years, saying this is the way a real conservative thinks. The trouble is, it seems like we're down to about 17 real conservatives left in the world who would even recognize what we're talking about.
Yeah, what is a real conservative?
That's the question. And as a libertarian myself with great conservative sympathies, the one advantage I think libertarians have philosophically over conservatives is that it's easy to identify, much, much easier to identify a libertarian precisely because we have the features that Russell Kirk was proud that conservatives did not have, because we are an ideology. We come right out and say that. We have certain principles we believe in, and if you don't believe in those principles, you don't belong to the club. Whereas with a conservative, it's harder.
Well, I just wanted to say that ideology is a tricky word. It could have a pernicious meaning and a better meaning. If by ideology you mean a reluctance to take into account or to adapt to historical circumstances, then it tends to become dubious. But if all of what you mean is that you have a systematic view of the whole, then I don't see that one could object to it.
Okay. Well, then I accept that caveat absolutely. Let's start off with your work that actually dates back to 1991, but is so relevant today, and that is The New Jacobinism. Just so the audience understands what you're saying, explain to us what the old Jacobinism was so that we can see exactly what it is that you are accusing the neoconservatives of.
The old Jacobins were the intellectual activists behind the French Revolution of 1789, or that is said to have started at 1789. It rolled on for quite a long time. And their idea was that the old society had to be flushed out, you needed to have a clean slate, and you had to implement what they regarded as universal principles. Freedom, equality, and brotherhood is how they summarized their ideology. And it struck me at an early stage when the people who came to be known as the neoconservatives were speaking about politics that they sounded very similar. They would make the argument, for example, that America is founded on universal principles, and they often want to say on abstract principles. That is to say, if you want to understand America, you don't look to its actual historically evolved culture and constitutionalism, but you look to these ideas which are supposed to make America unique. Now, the difference between the old Jacobins, who were French, and what I started calling the new Jacobins is that whereas the French had made France into the savior of nations, the missionary country, the new Jacobins had designated America for this role. And the role was to spread these universal principles, which they sometimes summarized as democracy. Sometimes they used freedom. But in any case, America is this exceptional country in that it was founded on these universal principles, and it is called by history, as it were, to help implement this view of society all over the world.
And the way they pitch it, the way somebody like a Bill Bennett, when he talks about moral clarity, what they seem to be saying is that if you don't believe in the way we are carrying out and exporting these principles, then you are a historicist or you are a moral relativist and therefore an enemy of true conservatism.
Yeah, here we can see a connection, not identity, but a connection between the so-called neoconservatives and what you might regard as a kind of an academic branch of much the same thing, namely the followers of Leo Strauss.
Right.
That is, the Straussians have this idea that as a philosopher, you are never respectful of tradition or history or the ancestral or the conventional. A thinker is always concerned about what Strauss calls the simply right, a sort of a model of right that exists quite apart from tradition. As a matter of fact, for the Straussians, there's always and necessarily a strong tension, even a radical opposition between philosophy and tradition, traditionally evolved authority. This is a very deeply held view on the Strauss among the Straussians. And so in this regard, there is a great deal of similarity between the Straussians and the neoconservatives in that they have tried to teach Americans that what makes America admirable and makes it unique is that it is based not on the bad old days, the traditions of the bad old days, but having seen the light, having seen principles. And these principles authorize the United States to try to remake the world, to kick out the dictators wherever they are so that democracy can flourish.
So you say that this, which is what is taken for granted by almost everyone, because everybody listens to right-wing radio who identifies as a conservative, this is not what conservatism is supposed to be. Well, then what is, if conservatism isn't spreading American ideals around the world and being a beacon of freedom and exerting American leadership, then what is it?
Well, that would require a mighty long response, but to try to focus on what makes traditional American conservatism different, very different from neoconservatism. The older conservatism was very much aware, so aware that it wouldn't even have to say it explicitly, that America has its roots in an old Western tradition. Specifically, Christianity is mediated by British culture. And you don't need to read very far into something like the Federalist Papers to see that Rome, Republican Rome, was very much on their minds. And these were, for the most part, very highly educated people by our standards, people who could write in Greek to each other, quoting poetry and such. And they, without making this always explicit, they always assumed that they were Brits who had been, as it were, displaced for one reason or another. They were living within American constitutionalism, which came out of British Western classical Christian tradition. And it's not a coincidence that they put together the kind of constitution that they did. They had the kind of personalities, the kind of culture, the kind of religious sensibility that would predispose them to write a constitution of precisely this kind. So if you want to understand what America was, and to some extent still is, you would need to investigate where America came from. And so you're led specifically to British tradition, the rights of Englishmen, the common law, and many other things British. And also you are led to Christianity, you're led to the classical heritage. In other words, you cannot really understand the mindset that created the U.S. Constitution if you don't know the historical origins. And that is precisely what the Straussians specifically do not want Americans to do. Harry Jaffa, for example, one of the Straussians who recently died and who was affiliated with the Claremont Institute, spent an entire career trying to persuade Americans that what makes America distinctive is that it breaks with the as he would have it, the bad old days. America is all about innovation. It's starting fresh. This is mankind taking a leap into the future and disregarding all of what went before. He says that to understand America is to celebrate revolution. We did, after all, have a revolution, did we not? Well, the historian looking at the same Constitution sees just the opposite, namely that the Constitution came out of a specific tradition. And you cannot hope to understand the Constitution, the real Constitution, which without looking at all of what lies implicit in it by way of a view of human nature and society.
Now, you mentioned the Christian tradition as being important to understanding the American tradition, but yet the neocon idiom, let's say, that they use when talking about the American obligation to intervene around the world is shot through with Christian imagery and Christian language. Is that just a cynical appeal to the religious sensibilities of their followers? Where does that come from? And couldn't they just as easily say, we too are making a Christian appeal, we are the city on the hill, and so on and so forth?
You are, of course, right that the rhetoric often sounds somewhat like the symbolism of the older tradition, but only somewhat. But this was true also of the old Jacobins. The French Jacobins frequently used phraseology that called to mind Christian symbols. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, for example, who greatly inspired Robespierre, one of the leaders of the Revolution, managed in large measure to sell his radical redefinition of morality by using Christian-sounding terminology. He wrote about simplicity of life, and he wrote about nature. He used all kinds of terms which are now used, not least by the Straussians, to signal that they may be standing in the same general tradition. But everything depends not on terms, but on how you define them, what you really mean by them. And there you find a rather sharp contrast between the Straussians and the neoconservatives on one side, and a more traditional conservative like Russell Kirk, to say nothing of Edmund Burke and various others in that tradition.
In fact, on today's show notes page, which would be tomwoods.com/490, I'll, of course, link to your books and to information about you, but I'm also going to link to a previous episode I did with Richard Gamble, who's done a whole book on the use of the city on a hill imagery, which is central to so much American government propaganda. And speaking of which, I want to read to you a sentence from an article you wrote 10 years ago talking about one of the great propagandists of our time, George W. Bush, who somehow managed to succeed in getting the United States into a war in Iraq that had nothing to do with anything. And you wrote this: "It should by now be obvious that, in his foreign policy views at minimum, the President of the United States is no conservative. He is a Jacobin nationalist." Take that, Rush Limbaugh. So tell me exactly what you mean. I bet we can figure it out by now, but tell me what you mean by that, and tell me how would a real conservative look at foreign policy or look at Saddam Hussein and respond?
Well, let me begin with the latter part of your question. Could one not argue that there is a particular approach to things that the U.S. Constitution embodies? It's about checking power, channeling power, taming power. Power seeking is potentially a huge problem, according to the framers. You need restraint. Now, restraint is going to be imposed by the institutions of the Constitution. That goes without saying. But they understood very well that you're not going to have people respect this restraint to be governed by law unless they have personalities to correspond to this constitutionalist temperament. And applying this general outlook to foreign policy, could one not argue that the very principle of restraint and of checking and balancing ought to be a natural outcome of this general outlook? The framers did not believe that any particular partisan interest had a monopoly on serving the common good. On the contrary, you had to listen to different points of view. The people in the other party might actually have a good part of the truth, surprisingly. That is to say, they would reject what you mentioned earlier, this idea of moral clarity that was popular on the neoconservative side. That is, if there is right and wrong, you have to have moral clarity, meaning you have to be on the side of right. But the problem is that given the epistemological condition of humanity, finding out just what is right is darn hard. And the framers recognized that. And so they believed that we should proceed under self-imposed restraints. We ought to deliberate, genuinely deliberate on these questions. It's hard to find the course. That's hard to know what the common good is. Well, that whole attitude naturally, from their point of view, would be applied to foreign policy. There, too, you do not have a monopoly on truth. Nobody has a monopoly on truth. You talk to the French about whether America is exceptional, and they will give you a debate on it. They will claim, how dare you call yourselves exceptional? Well, what about us? And the same with virtually every other people. So this notion that you have goodness and right on one side and sheer evil on the other is, of course, very alien to the constitutional temperament. And here we get to George Bush, who actually ran for president on a promise that he would want to install a more humble U.S. foreign policy. That's what he did. And so there were some people, I was one, who thought that possibly he might actually mean what he said in the election campaign. I was suspicious, however, because he had Paul Wolfowitz as one of his key foreign policy advisors. And of course, 9/11 gave the neoconservatives a golden opportunity to play upon the indignation of the new, rather inexperienced and not very learned president. And they fed him speeches, and he rather liked the tone of it. And so he gave that speech at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., where he said things like, you're either for us or you're against us. The assumption being that we are on the side of right, and if you're against us, you are you're supporting evil. And you got neoconservatives around that time who would write books with titles like End to Evil, which was co-authored by two leading neoconservatives. There's that whole mentality that you have good standing against evil is more Jacobin in quality than it is Christian. Now, it's true, Christianity between believes in good and evil. There is God and there is the devil. But for us human beings, it's sometimes exceedingly difficult to know what is the side of the angels and what is the other side.
But let's suppose we have a case of a regime that practically everybody would acknowledge is evil. There's still a difference in the way the neocons and a traditional conservative would look at it. The traditional conservative would never for a moment publish a book called An End to Evil. It wouldn't occur to him. What you do, as Richard Weaver says, is you try to limit evil. You try to hem it in the best you can, but you don't have this delusion that evil can be extirpated from the face of the earth. There's a completely different approach to issues like this between the two types of conservative.
Yes, and unfortunately, believing as the neocons did had disastrous consequences. That is, believing that democracy and freedom will flourish as soon as you kick out the dictators made them think about the war against Iraq the way they did. I had a curious experience just a year after the invasion of Iraq. David Brooks had written a column in the New York Times in which he conceded that he had had second thoughts about the invasion. It's not that he regretted that the U.S. was there, but he regretted what he called childish fantasies on his own part with regard to how easy it would be to install democracy in Iraq. Now, it is amazing that people with those kinds of childish fantasies, because that's what they are, would have been in charge pretty much of U.S. foreign policy. There was absolutely nothing unexpected about how the invasion of Iraq would turn out. Only if you were blinded by ideology of the bad kind could you have expected that the Americans would be greeted with flowers and that people would have rushed to the polls and cast ballots and you would have a wonderful regime. No, what happened in Iraq was virtually inevitable, and it could have been foreseen.
I'm going to I'll also link to an episode in which I had, now his name is escaping me, but a professor who'd written a book on the situation in Iraq and evaluating it after the fact, and he was on the left, but we had a very good discussion because he pointed out to me at one point, he said, I can't think of any political thinker farther removed from the neoconservatives than Edmund Burke, which I thought was quite interesting and revealing coming from him. But does it make you ever wonder, given precisely how easy it was to predict the outcome in Iraq, are you ever inclined to accept the theory that some of the neocons really couldn't have been that stupid? I can imagine George W. Bush falling for some of this.
Yeah, no.
But maybe some of them want the chaos.
Yes, I think that point needs to be considered. Looking at some of the writings of neoconservative intellectual activists, you have to ask that question. But that is to say, they're simply cynically using the kind of rhetoric that they think that the stupid yahoos will go for. But at the same time, I think there's also a matter of, what would you call it, self-persuasion. That is, by speaking this way over the years and communicating in these terms, you create a kind of imaginative inner life that makes you interpret events according to this view that you both hold and do not hold. I think the same, for example, with the Straussians. You find in so many of them a deep ambivalence about so many of the things that they say. They claim on the one side to be concerned about natural right and the universal. But on the other hand, so many of them are not at all persuaded, I'm not sure about Strauss, that natural right or the universal even exists. Somebody like Alan Bloom, for example, who wrote that bestseller, The Closing of the American Mind, I think was ultimately a kind of Nietzschean nihilist.
Okay, that's a wow. can you run with that a little bit? I didn't see that coming at all.
Well, it would take quite a long time to sort out everything that's...
Oh, well, sometime I'll have to have you on because you've got to elaborate on that at some point. That's not what I would have heard growing up as a young conservative at all.
No, that book, The Closing of the American Mind, which was a huge bestseller, was very greatly misunderstood, especially by so-called conservatives. They thought that Alan Bloom was offering a conservative philosophy, and he was going after the liberal establishment, but that was not at all the case. The mind whose closing he bemoaned in that book was the Enlightenment mind, as interpreted by him. And for him, the classical writer, Socrates, the philosopher, is a pre-Enlightenment philosopher. Alan Bloom stepped in the footsteps of, for example, Lewis Hart's, the liberal tradition in America. This is a typical example of the effort to reinterpret the American tradition so as to wean Americans off of their attachment to the actual historical origins of America. This is to persuade Americans that they are a new people, they started fresh, they swear by universal principles, and whatever you do, don't think that you can explain anything by going back into this outdated Christianity and the common law and the rights of Englishmen and Republican or Roman republicanism. That is, we've had for a very, very long time, starting in the late 40s and 50s, a surge of efforts to convince Americans that they are not what they thought they were. They are actually advocates of universal principles. Now, the question you broached was, could they really believe this about America as they apply it to foreign policy? That is that mankind has been waiting all of these years for America to spearhead democracy all over the world. Are they as naive as that? No, I don't think that they're quite as naive as that. Not all of them.
Professor Wren, let's take just a moment to thank our sponsor. Hey, everybody, I know you like listening to podcasts and to libertarian ones in particular. Well, I'm very glad to recommend to you the Jason Stapleton Program, hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. He runs Monday through Friday as well at jasonstapleton.com, and he has a 10-episode challenge. So that's 2 weeks. If you'll listen for 2 weeks, you'll walk away better informed, more knowledgeable, and better equipped to challenge both progressives and conservatives. No more being silent when the subjects of politics or economics come up. You'll know how to articulate what you believe with confidence. Jason's goal is to teach the value of individual liberty and economic freedom through current events. And so for a full hour, 5 days a week, Jason will cover the current political and economic news from a libertarian perspective. Jason was recently picked up by the USA Radio Network, making him one of the only nationally syndicated libertarian radio show hosts in America. So check out the Jason Stapleton Program at jasonstapleton.com. Before I let you go, I want to ask you, I'm going to ask you about your book in a minute, but I want to know, you must have thought this over. When did things go wrong? When did these the neoconservative and Straussian ideas take over? When was there a tipping point such that somebody like Russell Kirk couldn't have even gotten a start today in this atmosphere?
I don't think there was a tipping point. These things originate in the universities, and then they start simmer in the media. You would have to trace this back a long time. You can see that there's even a homegrown precedent for this in Woodrow Wilson, his desire to make the world safe for democracy, for example. Politically, and I'm not saying that politics is the hub of the wheel. I do not believe that it is. But politically, you could argue that a kind of a tipping point was the Ronald Reagan administration. That is to say, the neoconservatives were very fortunate to get a number of key positions in the Reagan administration. William Bennett, for example, very effectively did away with Reagan's commitment in the platform to do away with the U.S. Department of Education. Under his tutelage, the U.S. Department of Education doubled its budget. But in general, neoconservatives were quite numerous there, which irritated more traditional conservative movement types because they thought they were more entitled. But I would stay away from identifying any tipping point, to use your word.
You mentioned Bill Bennett. Of course, the man who had been in the running for that position, we all know, was Mel Bradford, M.E. Bradford, who had been in a fight with Harry Jaffa for years over intellectual battle over the nature of conservatism, whether equality, this abstract principle of equality, could be considered a constituent part of conservatism. He rejected that completely. But when you compare Bradford and his work to Bennett, I mean, Bennett wrote this totally sophomoric dissertation that has, I think in the works cited page, he's got 13 books for his PhD dissertation. I mean, this is the guy we got instead of the terrible Bradford. Like, that's neoconservatism in a nutshell, really. I want you to take a minute to tell us about your brand new novel called A Desperate Man. I had not known about this, but I guarantee you I will read it.
It's a moral and political thriller, pardon me. And it's an attempt to describe the condition of basically civilized people who find themselves in circumstances where everything seems to conspire against what they believe in. They see their society falling apart. And it's an attempt to explain or to show the plausibility of actions that they take. Now, this is supposed to No, it's not supposed to be, but it's called, it's reputed to be a page-turner. It may be. People seem to be really engaged by it. But I think it is, in general, an imaginative account of the state of our civilization. What's going to happen, and how will people deal with this? Are we ready to deal with a society that is going to fall apart? That's something that the reader will need to contemplate.
I'm going to link to that and other books of yours and a couple of your articles related to what we've been talking about at tomwoods.com/490. Well, Professor Wrenn, I'm extremely grateful to you. I wasn't sure I'd be able to get you on the show, and here you are. And as I say, I've been quoting you like crazy over the years, and it's just been a delight to talk to you. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, make sure and check out tomwoods.com/490 for more on this topic. I want to thank all you folks who have been helping me out by making your Amazon purchases through my Amazon link. It has made it possible for me to get somebody to do the audio for the show so that I don't have to do it. And, you know, there is some work that's involved in each episode, and that has freed me up. That's why I'll be able to produce more free ebooks. I'm working, as I told you guys, on a free guide, a systematic guide to self-publishing. I'm going to write a guide to podcasting. I'm going to be able to do all this stuff because I have the free time now. So you can do that. It doesn't cost you anything extra, but it helps me. And all you have to do is just type in tomwoods.com/Amazon, and it'll automatically take you to Amazon. It'll look like everything's normal, but secretly it'll know that you came from me. So do please use tomwoods.com/Amazon. It has made my life tremendously easier, given me a lot more free time, and I'm using that free time to produce more content for those of you who listen and enjoy the show. So thanks so much for doing that, and let's see, was there anything else I was going to say? No, I guess not. I'm sure I'll think of it tomorrow. All right, thanks for listening. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.